Oh, it's my job. I apologize.
That's all right. We'll wait for a second. You can see I have no financial relationships to disclose. So what is reproductive justice? Reproductive justice is an analytical framework that was pioneered by women of color in response to the ways that the pro-choice movement wasn't addressing the lived experiences of women of color. So in 1994, the women from the Black Women's Caucus went to the Conference on Population and Development in Cairo and saw the human rights model and came back to the United States and really wanted to apply that to women's reproduction. So in its most pared-down essence, reproductive justice means the right to bear a child, the right not to bear a child, the rights to access to social and economic support that's necessary to make those decisions, and also to parent the children we have with dignity and to control our birthing options. Of course, we get a little bit more complicated when you start talking to lawyers. So the articulation that comes from the Law Students for Reproductive Justice, which is one of my personal favorite articulations, says that reproductive justice will exist when all people can exercise the rights and access the resources they need to thrive and to decide whether, when, and how to have and parent children with dignity, free from discrimination, coercion, or violence. So as lawyers, we really like to look at things and break them down into their elements. And so the words that are highlighted in red are really sort of triggers for the different elements of the reproductive justice analytical framework. You can see equality, due process, social and economic access, dignity, and liberty. And these things can be applied to various aspects of women's reproduction. We're applying them to birth in this panel. They can also apply to environmental issues, the issue of environmental justice. But really, you know, those things, some of them you see are included within the United States Constitution, such as liberty, equality, and due process. And other ones of them really bear the hallmark of the human rights framework, including dignity and social and economic access, which were not really guaranteed under the Constitution of the United States. One of the biggest strengths of this analytical framework is that it's intersectional, first of all, and it recognizes the interplay of gender, race, and class, among other things, and also that it recognizes interconnectedness. I couldn't find a picture of the model that I wanted to use. It involves concentric circles, so you can look at these beautiful Kandinsky concentric circles while you imagine concentric circles with the woman at the center, and then, you know, a circle of her family, then her community or her tribe, culture, and expanding out into society, and recognizing the complex social circumstances in which women make their reproductive decisions. So if its strength is in recognizing interconnectedness, then the opposite of that would be separation and looking at issues in silos. So since Roe versus Wade, efforts to recriminalize abortion have mostly centered around passing laws that legally separate the fetus as a subject of judicial inquiry, literally erasing the pregnant woman within which the fetus exists and without which the fetus would not exist as a subject of inquiry. So these laws include laws such as Unborn Victims of Violence Acts and feticide laws, which create separate causes of action for the death of a fetus, separate from the pregnant woman, and the most radical of which include state constitutional amendments that would redefine a person to include fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses. One of these so-called personhood measures is currently before voters in Mississippi, and Proposition 26 would basically what it says is that the term person or persons shall include every human being from the moment of fertilization, cloning, or the functional equivalent thereof. Now, this is a really remarkable piece of legislation because it literally separates the fetus from the pregnant woman who carries it before they're even united by implantation, setting the beginning of a separate juridical entity at the moment of fertilization. And this is really revolutionary and almost the exact opposite of the concentric circles model that I described earlier. Now, proponents of this bill say that it's scaremongering to say that under this sort of legal scheme that women will go to prison or be investigated for unintentional loss of pregnancy. But we know that that's not the case because of one of our cases that's currently pending right now, a young woman by the name of Rennie Gibbs suffered a stillbirth, 16 years old, and tested positive for cocaine. And there's no evidence that the cocaine caused her to lose the pregnancy. And so we filed a motion to dismiss saying that the depraved heart homicide law, which is a non-capital murder offense that she was being charged under, didn't apply to the relationship between a woman and her fetus. That was not what the law was intended to cover. And that's been argued all the way up to the Mississippi Supreme Court, and we recently got a decision saying that basically dismissing rejecting the motion to dismiss. And so now this young woman is going to have to go to trial for murder for having suffered a stillbirth. So it's definitely not scare tactics. And just right next door in Alabama is piloting such a program, and they've charged a number of women who give birth to babies who test positive for an illegal substance with a crime of chemical endangerment. Now, the crime of chemical endangerment was a law that was passed in 2006 to prevent people from bringing children into dangerous locations. Specifically, they were thinking about methamphetamine labs. But it's really about, you know, bringing a born child, into a location. And by charging women who give birth to babies who test positive, again, we're seeing literally the erasure of the pregnant woman. She then becomes a location. The woman's body itself is a dangerous location for the child. And so these are supporters of a woman by the name of Hope Ankrum, who gave birth to a healthy baby who tested positive for methamphetamine. And she was charged under this law. And this was argued to a mid-level appellate court. You can see an NAPW staff attorney there all the way on the, I guess that's your right, I'm not sure. And we recently got back an opinion in that one, saying that this law, under this court's reading, the law did apply to a pregnant woman and her fetus because they could not see that there is any reason to hold that a viable fetus is not included in the term child, even though it's not expressly done so. And in fact, the legislature recently rejected a law that would change this chemical endangerment law to include pregnant women and fetuses. But this is how the court sees it. So I guess you may have a hard time believing me when I tell you that this is the less scary area of the law. Because to me, this is something that's, you know, frightening and agitating. But when we're talking about criminal laws, all these laws that I just, all the prosecutions that I just told you about were under criminal laws. All the protections that you know of, you know, from the Constitution, from watching Law and Order, you know, these procedural protections exist. But we're going to be talking about the child welfare system, where these protections do not always exist. They're definitely not universal. Things like the right to, trial by jury doesn't exist. The right to counsel does not necessarily exist. It depends on the jurisdiction. I come from a place where people do get public defenders in child welfare cases, not universally the case. And the system is scary for two reasons. It's scary for its legitimate purpose that it serves. This is a young girl by the name of Nixmari Brown who died a terrible death at the hands of the people who were supposed to take care of her. And I want to, you know, recognize and center in the fact that that the child welfare system does have a legitimate role to play in protecting children from harm from their caretakers. So that part's scary. But then it's also scary for the problems that it has. The Nixmari Brown cases, or, you know, any case, I'm sure every jurisdiction has a sensational case like that, really constitute a very, very small proportion of the cases that come before a child, a family court. So this is a rough approximation. There's a reason I don't put numbers on there, because I just want you to sort of visualize what it looks like. Of the cases that come to the attention of family courts, the vast majority of them are found to be non-victims. Either the family is entirely cleared, or they are given some services or something like that. And then of the ones that are found, that are substantiated, most of them are neglect. And what's problematic about neglect cases is that often conditions of poverty are sort of, I guess, if you define neglect to include conditions that exist in poverty, then you're going to end up with a system that is disproportionate by class. So the red represents the cases that are actually substantiated physical abuse or neglect, representing about 5 out of every 100 cases that come to the attention of the family courts. And these are the actual official numbers. And the reason the pie graph can't be accurate is because there are a lot of co-occurring forms of maltreatment. But you can see that the vast majority of the cases are neglect cases. And then the other scary part of it is the racial disproportionality. You can see here the difference in representation of children of color in the general population versus in out-of-home foster care. 60% of the children in foster care are children of color. African-American children are 4 times more likely, and Native American children are 3.5 times more likely to be removed from their homes. So a question that comes up very often in the birthing cases is, well, if the fetus and the woman are separate, isn't the woman still a parent to her fetus? Does she not still have, you know, parental rights? And that's absolutely true. You know, the right to parent is a fundamental right that's protected by the Constitution and by ample case law. And it's been determined that the right to conceive and raise one's child is essential. It's a basic civil right of man. The rights are far more precious than property rights, and the laws are, the right is protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and the 9th Amendment. And one of the, I guess one of the seminal cases on this says that it's cardinal for us that the custody, care, and nurture of the child reside first in the parents, whose primary function and freedom include preparation for obligations the state can neither supply for nor hinder. But the law gives and the law takes away. And this exact same case really circumscribes the right of a parent to make decisions on behalf of their child. And this includes medical decisions. So the right to parent, the right to make decisions on behalf of one's child is really a qualified right. And the entire system that I just described, the child welfare system, is created to give effect to the right of parens patria. Which is the right of the state to step in on behalf of those who can't speak for themselves. So here's what happens when parenting meets meets birthing, when this sort of the child welfare system meets birthing women. In New Jersey, a woman who declined to pre-authorize a cesarean section was reported to child welfare authorities and eventually had her parental rights terminated on the basis that she was endangering or medically neglecting her fetus. That decision has been overturned and it's working its way back up the court. And right now she stands a fair chance of having lost, losing her parental rights entirely. Her child is 4 years old and she's never had an opportunity to parent this child. In Illinois, a woman gave birth in a VBAC to a breech, baby in a breech position, and based on the theory that giving birth to a baby at home in a breech position was disregard for the baby's health, the baby was taken from her parents, placed in stranger foster care for the first weeks of her life, and the family spent months with the child not in their custody. She was in kinship care, fighting to get their child back. Now, these two states, New Jersey and Illinois, are states that are extraordinarily protective of individual rights. And what happens in states where that's not the case, in Florida, and you'll hear more about this case later, in Florida, a woman was ordered on bed rest and to have a cesarean section against her will. And the court in that case tellingly used the best interest of the child standard, which is the standard that's used in child welfare. Again, you can see the court looking at the fetus as though it were a child, stepping in as parents patria and saying, basically making the medical decision for the parents. And when guardians are appointed for fetuses, it creates this legal situation in which the fetus itself is a ward of the state. So it's tantamount to an orphan, or basically it's like an orphan inside the woman's body, or a legal adversary. Okay, so we're going to wrap it up pretty quick here. So if that's surprising, it probably shouldn't be. This is a statement from an editorial that was in The Lancet, I think it was earlier this year, saying that women have the right to choose how and where to give birth, but they don't have the right to put their baby at risk. This is a statement that the AMA agrees with. In 2008, they resolved to create model legislation saying that the safest place for birth is in a hospital or in an accredited birth center, which would almost certainly be used against pregnant women who were to give birth at home, because if the law says what is best for a child and you're looking and the legal standard that you're looking at is the best interest of the child, you have your legal standard right there. So the reproductive justice, this is a celebration of Halloween, the reproductive justice framework understands the complexity of the decisions that women make about their pregnancies, and these decisions are made not only as medical patients, but also as parents. But I think that we should be very careful about the danger of potential destruction of families that we would invite in by creating a legal foothold to consider fetuses as separate children. I have just a couple more things
to.
Okay, great. So, finally, the question of whether birth justice can exist if a fetus is legally separate from its mother even before birth. And my answer is no. The question is one of geography. That as long as a fetus exists within a woman, within another rights-bearing agent, any attempts to sever that bond will necessarily diminish the rights of the pregnant woman, whether they be rights as a patient or rights as a parent. And considering them together as opposed to legally separate allows her, first of all, to be the arbiter of the best interests of the child rather than empowering the state or outsiders to make that determination. And it also allows her to avail herself of the extensive and flourishing case law protecting individual liberties and the rights of patients. So I'll let you hum to yourself the Battle Hymn of the Republic as I read to you a little bit from John Stuart Mill on liberty, in which he says that the only part of conduct of anyone for which he is amenable to society is that which concerns others. And the part which merely concerns himself, his independence is of right absolute. Over himself, his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign. And the best articulation of this coming from U.S. case law, I think probably everybody on this panel, this is maybe their favorite passage from a case, comes from a relatively unknown case out of Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, in which a court ruled that one cousin could not be compelled to give bone marrow to another cousin. And the court in that case said, for our law to compel the defendant to submit to an intrusion of his body would change the very concept and principle upon which our society is founded. To do so would defeat the sanctity of the individual and would impose a rule which would know no limits. And no one could imagine where that line would be drawn. And I had never realized how Halloween appropriate this case was, because the court continues, for a society which respects the rights of one individual to sink its teeth into the jugular vein or neck of one of its members and suck from it the sustenance for another member is revolting to our hard-wrought concept of jurisprudence. Forcible extraction of living body tissue causes revulsion to the judicial mind. Such would raise the specter of the swastika and the Inquisition, reminiscent of the horrors this portends. So amazingly, when you Google Nazi, zombie, vampire, like all the things that are evoked by this imagery, this is what you get. I think it's amazing. So because I didn't want to close on that slide, I just want to say in conclusion that the law is very good at these separations. We are extraordinarily good at, the sort of language of autonomy and, you know, my body, my choice, like we sort of are familiar with that messaging. And that in order to effectuate reproductive justice for birthing women, to create birth justice, we have to stop the separating and really focus on the interconnectedness of the pregnant woman to her family, her society, and her community. Thank you.